From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. Illinois' rich African-American history is well documented in Champaign County, and now a new bus tour gives residents a unique way to experience it. Emily Hayes boarded the bus and takes us along the first tour.
How are we feeling? Cold? Good?
Good.
Warm?
Good.
Excited? Excited to learn?
About 30 young and old, mostly white and black people, almost fill up the charter bus on this cold morning.
My name is Estella Sammy. I am the destination experience manager.
Trying not to elbow our seat partners, we shuffle off our heavy coats while listening to our tour guide.
And the trail began in late 2020 when a Champaign County resident came to my organization about installing a mural to reflect the history of African Americans in our community.
Experience Champaign Urbana is the official tourism organization for Champaign County. And Sammy says the murals led to historical markers and now the bus tours.
My name is Kimberly France, and I wrote the book Black Settlements in Southern Illinois.
France is my seat partner and a historian from Carbondale. She started her research with her own family.
My grandmother grew up in Thompsonville in an area that I thought was family land, and I came across a cemetery directory, and there were over 40 black families that lived there, and I knew I wasn't related to them, and so that's how I discovered that it was a black settlement.
Eventually, she discovered black settlements in all 16 of the southern Illinois counties she looked into. Some formed as early as the 1700s around salt and coal mines and railroads. They put down roots with churches, cemeteries, and schools, but many of the communities dispersed due to tornadoes, periods of violence, or the draw of integration. The tour's second stop is the courthouse in Urbana.
Until 1972, no African American had been elected to a countywide office in Champaign County. That all changed with James R. Burgess Jr. So at the age of 26, he was drafted into the U.S. Army.
Sammy tells us how Burgess became a leader in the Army, served for 20 years, and then went to law school at the University of Illinois. He joined the county state's attorney's office and after 3 years won the election to lead the office. 10-year-old Charles Hoskins loves history.
Why do you think this history is important?
I think it's important because it can repeat itself one day. Like, it can happen again. Like, there might be the 100th black person be elected there, something like that.
His mom, Jessica, teaches at the Rise Center at Columbia. The space houses Champaign Unit 4's alternative education programs.
Where I teach, I'm not too far from it. We could probably even go over there and read and learn about some of the history that way as well. Maybe a tour might be a little bit too much for younger kids.
Stop 5 is our tour guide's favorite place.
This is Bousfield Hall, one of the University of Illinois residence hall, and it is named after Model Tanner Brown Bousfield.
Bousfield was the first black woman to enroll at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in 1903. She went on to be the first black principal of a Chicago high school.
So this university residence hall opened in 2013 in her honor. But it is worth noting that while she attended the university, she would not have been allowed to live on university housing. African Americans were not allowed to live on campus until 1946.
Sammy says the story is a reminder of who paved the way for her as she finishes her college degree.
It's so important now, as largely the black history is trying to be erased. So doing these tours to keep it alive, keep it fresh in our heads.
She was especially upset the day the U.S. Air Force removed its training videos about the Tuskegee Airmen, the nation's first black pilots trained in Rentoul.
Because now it's up to us. If other people are going to try and silence this, erase it, make it so people don't know, it's up to us as people, as community members, to show it.
The Air Force says it was obeying a directive from President Trump to end federal diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, but after bipartisan backlash, the videos are back. Some nonprofits, like Experience Champaign Urbana, are worried Trump will block funding they are using for race-related initiatives like the bus tour.
As of right now, I think we believe we're in the clear. We're not 100%, I think.
After almost 2 hours, we are back where we started, in Champaign at the Douglas Center. Kimberly France packs up her notebook and begins putting on her coat.
Do you have any closing thoughts?
What I hope happens going forward is that more communities begin to capture and record and preserve their history and share it. And I'm hoping that this becomes the a piece in a larger puzzle of Illinois history.
I caught up with Jessica Hoskins and her son Charles after they got off the bus.
Learned about Miss Bossfield and how long it took for African Americans just to even live, be able to live on campus. It was pretty interesting. Even learning about King School, because I'm from the area, but I didn't even know all the history behind it.
Do you have any final thoughts you want to?
I saw other murals along the way, but my mom kept telling me they were not part of them. But they still look great. I think everything went well.
Experience Champaign-Urbana plans to run the public tours 4 times a year, in addition to private tours for schools and other organizations. I'm Emily Hayes with IPM News.
You're listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. There was a time in America that black people had to walk around with papers or a special badge to show whether they were enslaved or free. One of those badges, a painful reminder of America's history, is on display for the first time at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. Another artifact making its premiere is a recruitment poster for African Americans to join the Union Army during the Civil War. We recently talked with the museum and library's executive director, Christina Schutt. She served in that role since 2021. Before that, she was based in Little Rock, Arkansas, where she served as executive director of the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center, which focuses on African American history. Here's Schutt's conversation with Brian Mackey, host of The 21st Show.
If you came to Springfield to see the tag, what you would see is a small badge. It's a sort of diamond-shaped badge. It has the word Charleston imprinted on the text. It would be about the size of a little bit bigger, but kind of between a quarter and maybe the palm of your hand, somewhere in between there. It's stamped with the number 181, which would have meant that that was the 181st badge issued that year. It has, of course, the name Mechanic on it. Mechanic referring to someone who was a laborer, right? A carpenter, a skilled worker. And then the name or the number 1819, referring to the year that it was issued. And then, of course, in the back of the badge, it has the word LaFar, referring to LaFar, who was the person who issued the badges, created them.
What was the purpose of a badge like this?
So these badges were primarily issued to enslaved laborers who were being leased out in Charleston, South Carolina. So in 1819, we know that there were somewhere about 2,240 or so of these badges issued to people. So as an enslaver, what you would have done if you didn't need, for example, your carpenter to do any work for you, you would have leased that person out and you would have had him do work maybe for the city, building bridges or repairing boat work or doing some other type of labor. And then whatever wages that he earned, those wages would have been given to you as his enslaver. And so that was one way in which Charleston as a city and as enslavers benefited from work that sometimes they didn't need.
How common was this sort of identification requirement?
Well, many cities across the United States, there was sort of a history of having kind of identification or having some piece, right, of paper to identify people's enslaved movement. Charleston, South Carolina is actually very unique in the sense that it's the only city that we know of to date that issued these metal badges and did so year after year, beginning in about 1783 when they passed a city ordinance that required them. They also, for a brief couple of years, mandated that any free black people living in Charleston, South Carolina, have a badge as well. And so badges were issued in that case, but they were primarily used for tracking the movements of enslaved laborers.
Why the free? What do we know about the rationale for making freedmen and women wear this?
Well, the rationale was using this as another way in which to really to license and to dictate the movement of Black people. You know, you think about if you were a person who had to have a badge to leave your home, to do any work in the city, that you had to pay a tax for that. You had to be licensed the same way that we would license a vehicle today. If you had to do these sorts of things, right, and these extra requirements that were placed on you, it was meant as a form of intimidation. It was meant as a form of helping to control the Black population in the city, because, of course, African Americans overwhelmingly outnumbered whites in the town. And so this was one way in which kind of keeping tabs on people.
Yeah. Says a lot about the way we treated Black men and women in America before the Civil War. Somebody made the point I was talking this morning. It's almost like the way we think of car registrations today.
Absolutely. And I think it's so important that we document, that we talk about this history, that we share this kind of documentation, because it speaks to that, the broader importance of African-American history. It helps give contextualization for the long struggle for civil rights. I mean, one of the kind of flip sides of, you know, an object of oppression like this is that it also signifies the kind of the skilled labor that was present within the Black community. You know, oftentimes I've heard, right, people talking about enslaved people as if they didn't have skills, the docile, right? This was one of the lies that the Confederacy and oppressors and segregationists used for years. And these badges really speak and stand in stark contrast to that, that these people, these men, and in some cases women, you know, were highly skilled. Right. They were skilled enough that they were worthy to be sent out. Right. And their labor leased out.
You know, I'm always fascinated by how objects like this, common objects that most people wouldn't think was, you know, worthy of keeping around after that year had expired and they got the badge stamped 1820. What do we understand about how this survived from, you know, someone walking around Charleston, South Carolina, to being on display in 2025 in Springfield, Illinois?
Yeah, it is sort of remarkable. I mean, I think one of the reasons that these badges survive is because they are made of metal. Unlike paper, that tends to be even more kind of less tangible, it's harder to preserve, right? These metal tags would have, as the city of Charleston fell during the Civil War, likely would have been tossed into the dirt, right? Buried under rubble. And that's one of the reasons why they do get preserved, right? It's because they're sort of lost as these kind of tiny elements. Lost in time. You know, for us, I think the preservation and keeping these badges and putting it on display as we've done is really, again, this kind of this testament to this deeply painful history that we share as a country. But it's also an opportunity to reflect on and think about not only how far we've come, but where we want to be. What are the lessons and things that we can learn from this time period about places we don't want to be as a country and things we don't want to have happen again? And how can we use this tag, which was meant to strip humanity from people, right? We don't learn the person's name who owned this badge. It's just a simple number, 181. And yet, how can we value an individual's humanity and people's humanity in today?
We're talking for the last part of our program today about two pieces of Black history from the 19th century that recently went on display for the first time at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. You mentioned paper doesn't survive as well. This piece did. It's new to the museum. This was a sort of a painting or a poster used to recruit Black men for the U.S. Army after Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. Describe the art for us.
Yeah, so this poster features a Union soldier, United States soldier, holding a flag, an American flag that says freedom to the slave, right? Proclaiming freedom. One of my favorite things about this poster is that it also features these beautifully iconic images, like a schoolhouse where Black people are learning how to read. You actually see a Black man in the foreground reading a newspaper, talking about freedom and the Emancipation Proclamation. We have Black soldiers soldiers who are valiantly fighting to defend the United States against the armed insurgency. And then my favorite piece across this is that not only do you have these Black soldiers who are extending their arms to enslaved people, but you have enslaved Black people themselves breaking their chains and rising up. So whereas in many posters or many iconography of the time, it's often a white person who's leaning down to help an enslaved African up. In this case, the Black men themselves are breaking their chains and lifting themselves up. On the reverse of the poster, it proclaims the proclamation, right? All slaves were made free men by Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States. Come then, able-bodied colored men, to the nearest United States camp and fight for the Stars and Stripes. And it's just such a rousing and joyous poster, right? Meant to encourage Black men to come and fight for the United States.
And yet there was ambivalence about that, right? William Sherman famously did not want any African-Americans in Uncle Billy's army. He put it a lot more crudely than that. And they couldn't be officers, for example. I'm not sure if the officer depicted here is meant to be African-American or not. But talk about the challenge that these men faced.
They faced an unequal service from the beginning. You know, I think one of the things that actually Lincoln is sort of charged with, it, he's getting all of these, like Sherman, like other of these white officers who are writing to him and saying, well, should we just have the Black people serving in menial tasks? Should we just allow them to cook our food? Should we just, they're asking him these questions because they don't want to put them in combat roles. There was real fear among the white population that Black men would run scared at the first sight of bullets, of enemy fire, or that they would take up arms and attack all white people. And in fact, that's not what happened. They actually fight valiantly. They fight brilliantly against the Confederates. And so Lincoln's getting all these letters, and he actually brilliantly writes back and says, you know, you say you are not willing to fight for the Negro, but the Negro is willing to fight and die for you. And I love that sort of sentiment that Lincoln actually sees the valiance with which they're fighting, and he acknowledges it. In one case, actually, Black men aren't given equal pay. They're actually paid less than their white counterparts, and they refuse that pay until the end of the Civil War, where they finally not only get that pay, the equal pay that they deserve, but they get it back in full, the back pay wages as well. So, you know, from the outset, Black men and Black people realize not only what the true cause of the Civil War was, but also what the opportunity is if the United States wins, that it means freedom forever for them and their families.
What do you hope ultimately people take away from these pieces of Black history, American history?
Well, I hope people see that it's just that, that it is American history, that is worthy to be talked about, that is worthy to be told, that there is no fear in telling the truth in history. You know, I hear a lot of times where people are maybe fearful or don't think that we should talk about, these pockets of history, these important pieces of history. But I think pieces like this, these artifacts, really speak to our historical past. They speak to where the United States has been, and also give us hope and possibility for where we can be in the future. You know, one of the things about the United States during the Civil War, the Union, right, is that it's a country that is willing to fight together to preserve and build something different. And they didn't know what it would be. Abraham Lincoln didn't know. He didn't start the Civil War thinking that he was going to immediately end slavery by the end of it. But that was sort of the possibility, and that was what abolitionists and what enslaved people really pushed for and had happened. And so by telling these fuller and more complete stories of American history, I hope that that we as a country can be better grounded in our history to know not only where we've come from, but where we can go into the future.
That was Brian Mackey of The 21st Show talking with Christina Schett, the executive director of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. And they were talking about two new artifacts of Black history now on display. That's all for this week's dialogue. Our team includes host and producer Kennedy Vincent, producer and editor Ariel Ravini, reporter Emily Hayes, and yours truly, Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are part of Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.